Good evening. You're very welcome to the one-to-one show with me, Aisling O'Loughlin. We're going to be tackling two big ones this evening, transhumanism and the Great Awakening, which is quite frankly looking more like the Great Snooze as we speak. Joining us this evening is a man of many, many talents. He's a barrister of law, specializing in international law. What else? He's a poet, he's a writer, he's an artist. And the list goes on. James Tunney, you're very, very welcome to the show. You're living in Sweden at the moment. How's that going for you?
Well, thank you very much, Aisling. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Yeah, I've been living in Sweden for quite a few years now. I lived in Scotland before that. So it's been fine for me here. It's worked out grand, bringing up a family. I like the landscape. There's something like 100,000 lakes in Sweden. I really enjoy that. It's really grown on me. Swim a lot up in the lakes. So I should have been up at the lake swimming now for my second swim today, but I've given it over to you. So I hope you appreciate that.
You're a brave man to be swimming in those lakes.
It's been grand. We've have considered living in different places around the world. My wife wanted to move to Ireland. I'm delighted that I didn't move to Ireland. I'm sad to say. Or Britain, for whatever reason, it's been quite well handled here hitherto in Sweden. It's been fairly normal. So when I compare it with other countries, I'm delighted at my instincts. For whatever reason, we're to stay here. So who knows what will happen in the future? But hitherto, it's been grand. So it works out fine for me. I'm not interested in a lot of public affairs here. I concentrate on writing in an international context, in a more cosmopolitan context, and painting. So in many ways, I get on with my own stuff, and I'm not interested in public affairs here. I am interested in global affairs and patterns that happen around the world.
Well, as I was saying to you earlier, like one of the really good things to come out of this chaos, essentially, is, you know, we're getting to hear the great voices, the great thinkers, the people who've put in the hard yards, who have thought deeply, who have read the books, understand the references. And, you know, you're one of those voices, and we're delighted to have you on the show. You've written many books. One of them was Ireland, I Don't Recognize Who She Is. And the two you've written this year, I'd love you to talk a bit about it. One is Empire of Scientism, which was published in April of this year. And the other is Tech Bondage, Slavery of the Human Spirit. So will you tell us a little bit about that one, Tech Bondage?
I used to write kind of academic articles, all this stuff that people say is fantastic, you know, internationally peer-reviewed five-star journals and various other things where you go through a process in the academic world. So I wrote on a diverse academic topics and indigenous rights, Aboriginal rights, international communications, technology law, intellectual property, EU law. In the last year before I left the academy, I was invited both by the Chinese Academy of Social Science and the High Court of Beijing and the European Academy or the Academy of European Law to talk on issues. So I was at a decent level in that context. So I decided to move to Sweden. When I left academia, I looked after the kids, was a stay-at-home father, and I concentrated on painting. So I left all that behind. So I was painting, and I intended to write. I intended to write in creative stuff. It was painting first, and writing would come along. And for various instances, I became interested in mysticism, and I went on that path. And I found that the mystic stuff, I wrote a little book called The Mystical Accord about the mystical journey and how one evolves spiritually, as I could see it. And as I was inspired to do so. And in that as well, there was a sense of foreboding about technology. Now, I had lectured in subjects on communication technology. I'm not a techie. I'm not a geek. I'm not interested in the detail, as you probably gathered so far. But I'm very interested in the phenomenon of the forces and the implications. And that's sometimes the thing that people don't look at. They're so fascinated with the objects. They're in a kind of fetishistic way. So out of that, I had a sense of the foreboding, which I wrote another little book called Blue Lies September, which is a very, it was a first attempt at a novel. It's, and I just self-published that because nobody interested in publishing a novel like that, because it was about a situation where there was a catastrophe in London and there was lockdowns and curfews and extraordinary police powers and draconian legislation. Now, this was before the process. So I had I did have a sense of foreboding, both from a kind of spiritual sense or a perceptive sense or an artistic sense, and also from my analysis of what was happening, you know, in various forces that I had seen from context that I'd been in. And that led me then to say, okay, well, I believe that we're going to enter, we're entering now into an end game which is associated with the arrival of a Scientocracy, which has been predicted for a long time and has also been a policy. So I said, I didn't want to come into the public eye. I think it's in many senses, it's a cesspool. The media has been a disgraceful propaganda machine in all countries. It's not just in Ireland or in France or in Sweden or in the United States. It's everywhere because it's controlled in various mechanisms, but through the propaganda machine. But Chomsky and other people explain that. So I said, okay, well, let me explain. This is my best analysis of what's happening. And so my first pamphlet, I called it, was The Empire of Scientism. So what is happening, in my view, is that we are moving into a global empire. So this is what the globalists have been working towards. Now, it doesn't matter whether they're left or right. They're both the same in this context. There's no distinction. This is a falsehood. It's a false distinction. Mm-hmm. They're both materialist, physicalist agendas. And this empire is building on all the imperial systems that were there. The British Empire it didn't go away, but it's like energy. It transforms into a different form. It transmutes, being said. So the first set of interviews I did was with Jeffrey Mishlove on New Thinking Aloud, who's the famous parapsychologist in the United States. And I did one interview on globalization. And this, we did it in January 2020. So I said in that, before this thing was happening, that what would happen is that we would have the force which would rise in globalism was scientism. Now, by scientism, I mean not science, but the abuse of science, the appearance of science, the use of scientific authority for other ends beyond the scope of its method. I said that scientism would take over. It would unite the left, the right, communism, corporatism, and this was the future. It would supersede all other globalism. It was the agenda, and that the events which would be precursors to that would come from science itself. So lo and behold, if the hypothesis that was emerging through those books was true, it manifested in events for me in relation to the Wuhan lab and the origin of this, the origin of this virus. And in that book you mentioned Ireland, I don't recognize who she is. I had Australian fruit bat virus as what they were getting vaccinated for. And when I saw a picture of the poor bats that they're persecuting in these little cages in Wuhan, you say, it looked like a fruit bat to me, because I've seen a lot of these fruit bats in Australia, and they're beautiful creatures. Nobody seems to be bothered about why they're torturing all these bats and for what reason, or why science, continues to believe it's a good idea to engage in these topics. That's another story. So The Empire of Scientism was the culmination of a set of works that happened before the crisis. What I'm saying is that we're facing a global empire, that the doctrine, the ideology will be of science, worship of science, but scientism, not real science, but the appearance of science. And that will be has to be a dictatorship. It's a dictatorship which is facilitated by the convergence of technology. It has been going on for a while. It's going on in particular from the 1920s. There has been an agenda laid out. J.D. Bernal, who was an Irish scientist born in Tipperary, laid it out that the scientists would take over the world. I mean, he's a very respected scientist and crystallographer that had a big influence on DNA exploration. So he said that he was a Marxist and a Stalinist, and that kind of went together. But it also comes from the right, so it can't be fit into any box. The similarities is that they're materialist. He said that scientific corporations in stealth would take over the world, that they then would be able to manage the docile population. They would then begin to mechanize the human body, and people that didn't go along with this mechanization could live in a human zoo for the purposes of experiment. So, I mean, that's the way. The
not great. I mean, it's not looking great for humanity. The trajectory we're on already, and you know, so a lot of people don't even know that they've taken a nanotechnology into their system with this mRNA nanotechnology, which has been called a vaccine. I mean, it's not looking good for humanity where we're at right now. I mean, you've written about dystopian future, but the dystopia seems to be happening. It seems to be happening before our very eyes, but people don't seem to want to face into it or to really look, you know, behind the curtain and see what is going on behind the scientism.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I mean, people will probably then say, oh, well, I'm anti-science. This was a scientist that said that. And that torch has been passed to Arthur C. Clarke and to the contemporary ones. And they're saying the same thing. They're saying, for example, if you don't want to be changed, they're beginning to say this already, well, then you are a human racist. Mm-hmm. That's the new idea, that you're against other beings that they want to create. And this is an old story. It's an old story going back to Dr. Faustus and Christopher Marlowe, based supposedly or debatedly on a magician in Germany. And magic is an important idea. I mean, people don't take magic seriously, but there's a lot of academic study about what magic is. It's not just Harry Potter. There are people who engage in magic, and a lot of what we're seeing in the media is associated or fits into a process of magic. And the connection between scientism and magic is quite close.
Oh, yes, you know, quite a cultist. Yeah. But even having to say yes, you know, like no is the magic word, but not enough people are saying no. But even the idea of consenting to the needlework, consenting to the injection is a big part of it. Like, because you've consented to the deal of moving towards essentially transhumanism.
Well, the problem is, and this is a problem I would concede to people, that I created space for myself, and I've been studying these things for years, and I talked to people in various. It took me a long time to put things into a coherent policy. So there's a lot of fragmentation, and it's very, very difficult. So I'll concede that point to people. So you may say, well, I don't really understand what's going on, and I'll bow to this authority. But there's a certain point. If you take the example in Ireland of the financial crisis, where there's tapes of, as you know, of the people laughing at the Irish people and how they were fooled. I mean, you think they'd be a bit annoyed at that the public have transferred billions of money, of resources to international bankers who sneer at them. And that same principles underlie this whole idea of people who have been meeting internationally, who have been defying the democratic process to create this new system. So a thing that I began to notice in Ireland, because my family were involved in politics, I didn't get into it, but it gave me an ear to what was happening in various ways. And Ireland is good in some sense because it's so small, so you can see what's happening. And without pointing fingers at anyone, but you can identify the figures that were going to succeed by the degree to which they attended these international, you know, Bilderberg and the files that were released. You could anticipate that. It's remarkable. There's a remarkable correspondence between them. And this is all over the world. And all these groups, the democratic process was ceded to these transnational spaces, which were beyond regulation. So that could happen. So people don't know all these things. But that having been said, we are in what Yuval Harari said or anticipate would be a digital dictatorship. If they don't see that everything that was predicted in recent times about where this was going is happening, well, then people are deliberately blind and they're acquiescent. And so now they're making a choice. And Hannah Arendt talked about this in relation to authoritarianism. So she was married to Gunther Anders, who was the son of William Stern, who was the leader in child psychology. And he was the leader in a very important doctrine of personalism, which focused on the significance of the person. So Gunther Anders, he changed his surname. He was married to Arendt, and both of them were interested in totalitarianism. And Gunther focused on the power of television. They were married for a few years and they split up, but he focused on the power of television and how this was becoming from the 50s, a power to manipulate people in a really deep sense, because he'd seen what happened in Germany. But if you go back and look, as you're familiar with Arendt's essay, she said that the greatest problem in a dictatorship first is with your friends and family, because they don't want to admit it. And you will find the greatest difficulties, not with the state, funnily enough, not with the Nazis coming, but with the people around you who refuse to see what's going on. And this pattern of refusing to see what's going on is a thing which has happened again and again in authoritarian systems. To put it, just in case any of that sounds vague, to finish off on that point, actually, we are in a dictatorship now. There's no question. And sometimes in Roman law, there was a kind of a legitimate role for dictatorship in time of crisis, for example, war or whatever, threat to the state. This is not it. We're in a dictatorship. We're in a moving into a totalitarian regime, a global regime. Make no mistake about it. So I'm saying that. I'm making that statement with the best judgment that I have, and people can say I'm mad. We are moving into a totalitarian regime. There's a big difference. This is no mere totalitarianism, if you want to say. This is total totalitarianism. Never before Hitler, Mao Zedong, never before had any despot had the instruments to be able to directly interfere into the human body and mind in the way they do and control them. And we have allowed that to happen. So now the next stage, as the scientists have said, because science is behind a lot of this, before people go on about the left and deconstruction, science was the great deconstructor. So now they're coming into the body and they can do that. They have the technology. They believe that they're entitled to, because part of this mentality is we understand the world, we're entitled to govern you. And so what I would say to the people that are doubtful, look at what the scientists have said. Look at what they're saying. You are condemning your children, not you actually, but the people who don't pay attention to this are condemning themselves and their children and their grandchildren to first a type of imprisonment or enslavement, and then secondly, to be in the same position as the bats in the cage, to be subjects of experiments. How do I know? Because the scientists have said that. Look at what Bernal said in 1929. And that was supported by H.G. Wells. He wrote a book. He says, people say about conspiracy theory. He wrote a book called The Open Conspiracy, which was based on the idea of global government by scientists, attack religion, attack the nation state, attack the family. And then you say, okay, science, us enlightened people will rule the world. He called it the open conspiracy. And then he wrote the New World Order. And people say, well, this is a conspiracy theory. Look, and now he started off studying scientists. Some of the other scientists didn't like him, but he was in the science milieu around the same time. So they have said it. So I'm listening to the scientists. The scientists have said they will create this totalitarianism. My father was born in 1980, and he's dead a good few years ago. But in that space of time, because you also see it just before then in futurism, the Italian futurists, 1909, they began to say, we love speed, we love death, we love war, we love machines. This love of machine is very, very destructive. It goes with this magic. So they have said it. There's 100 years of evidence that they were going to create a totalitarian regime of science, a scientocracy. This is here. I am. This argument is one that I'm not going to change. And I've spent a long time. When I taught in law, I didn't give people my opinions. I didn't give personal opinions. I gave them objective statements about what the law was. I've stayed out of things. I've stayed out of politics largely. We're living in an emergent totalitarian regime, which I call the empire of scientism. It's a scientocracy, a technocracy, technotronic society, different ways. There's no doubt about that. And if you're not, all I would say to people is just check out that theory, check out that hypothesis. I'm not selling anything beyond that, beyond my books and paintings. I'm not doing a political party. I'm not left or right. And look at what they have said. So sorry for going on.
And
so
also,
long.
You know, also you could say, you know, people say, how do you know what you're saying is true? Because it's happening. It's happening before our eyes. You see, I think the big issue for people is they're waiting to see it on the news, or they're waiting for the television to tell them it's happening, or they're waiting to open the Irish Times, they're waiting to read about it in the newspapers and be told this is happening. And it's not going to happen in the mainstream media. And I think that has been, you know, a big part of people still being asleep and not quite comprehending the gravity of this situation and how much we are in threat as a species. And maybe it is the end of the road for, you know, the human being.
There is a very strong, it's hard for, if you like, nice, decent people to understand. There's a lot of people that are not nice and not decent out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of manipulative people, a lot of psychopaths, that rise up to power. Take the example that's current at the moment in relation to Afghanistan. It was patently obvious that the West was not going to win in Afghanistan. Why they went in there, I've talked to people like George Galloway and that right from the start, they predicted all this. They said the troops would be home at Christmas. He said it will take 10 Christmases before, you know, and he underestimated it. But he was clear, because if you look at the history, even take from a kind of more right-wing perspective, the book Caravans by Michener, explaining about all the people that had lost in Afghanistan. And as Galloway said, well, if Alexander the Great couldn't beat win in Afghanistan, Donald Trump was not going to. Not, and I'm not saying anything about Trump in this case, because he was clear about what he wanted withdrawal. But
did they ever want to win anyway? Were they just there for a war?
Here's the interesting thing. Then you say, well, why are they involved? Well, of course, war is a racket. War is a racket. So all the people that went along with this, that were willing to have their loyalty manipulated to serve these big machines, they did so, you know, with the people behind it knowing that it wasn't going to win. And interestingly, the war in Afghanistan was what destroyed the Soviet Union. So you would have to ask yourself whether this was a kind of car crash kamikaze thing, which seems to be part of the Western system. Because if you want to achieve globalism, one of the best ways to do it is to overextend. Empires, or particular empires, fall when you overextend them. But so it was all a lie. I was in New York, just around the corner from the UN, the day when Colin Powell was telling lies about Iraq. Do people not remember that? Do people not remember that all these same, some of these same guys that were on the news, I was watching these guys, I didn't know who they were. They're still there on the networks, saying the same.
Tony Blair, when you hear Tony Blair coming and giving his chuppence worth, you think, how dare you? Like, how dare he have a space to be able to tell us what's going on now at this point, after everything that he's done, you know? It's really remarkable that anybody would listen to Tony Blair.
Even Gaddafi, who anticipated what was going on, who anticipated that they were going to stitch him up, you know, Blair going over doing his psychopathic kind of smiling over there, mm-hmm. and intending to, you know, the sequence of events that led to his killing in that context was part of that. They knew that, and of course that was handy in order. What Gaddafi said was interesting. He said the only thing that really is stopping me being removed is that they don't want a whole lot of emigration coming up from Central Africa into Europe. But he made a mistake. They did. And you say, well, why is that? Now, I'm not going on any issue about emigration and all these, because in all these issues, the people that are being pushed are innocent as well. You know, it's like it's a process of plantation, and that's an important idea. We know about the history of plantation in Ireland. You take one group of people and you plant them in there, and then you know that will solve a problem for, they'll be yinging and yanging for a few hundred years. Mm-hmm. And that plantation model in Ireland was taken to the United States on the plantation, the cotton plantation, different form, but they did a similar process. So the people that have the resources know, and the imperial structure that they can, through plantation, they can stop homogeneity. Now, a very significant Irish player in this is Peter Sutherland, who's dead now. And he, of course, was Irish Attorney General, Director General of Competition in Europe, head of the World Trade Organization. And then he was appointed for his interest in human rights, which hadn't manifested before. You know, he was head of Goldman Sachs and British Petroleum. But then all of a sudden he's talking about migration. And he went to the House of Lords and said, you have too much homogeneity in the United Kingdom. I mean, it's unbelievable. So the sole purpose for his reasons as part of that apparatus was to stop homogeneity so that you wouldn't have any homogenous group that could oppose the will of the globalists who want the Scientocracy. It's very, very clear.
Divide and conquer. Now, I want to steer you back to the Great Awakening, because we could talk about so much with you. We could be here all day.
The Great Awakening is big news for me.
It is big news. We're kind of waiting for the Great Awakening. Even when you say there's a few, and when I say there's a few of us, it's like, am I even awake? I have to say, you know, I'm aware of certain things happening, but what am I awake to? It's like awakening is a good word, all right. Is anybody waking up or what? Or like, do you see an awakening happening? I mean, it's written in the books, you know, it is foreseen that we're supposed to wake up at some point. Do you see it happening?
I'll have to say, I don't see a lot of evidence of it. Now, so I don't want to be miserable about it. And people often say, oh, no, there's no glimmer of light in this. That's not what I say. I would say the first thing is that people have to go on their own journey. It's an individual journey. They have to take a look at the evidence, take a look at the world. They have to inform themselves. They have to look at what's happening. They have to come to their own conclusion about what's happening. Now, in France, there is some hopeful opposition, not currently, but we go back to 1577, and De La Boite, Emmanuel De La Boite, who wrote about involuntary servitude. The argument, and he couldn't understand it then, was why people gave their sovereignty away to tyrants. He couldn't understand it then. He believed that the tyrants couldn't work without people voluntarily acquiescing, and that is mm-hmm. true. And also in France, of course, you had the anti-technology movement that was led by Jacques Ellul and Bernard Charbonneau in the Aquitaine region. And they saw that early on. Now, Ellul was in the French resistance, and he came from a Christian background. He had been Marxist, but he went away from that. But he understood that technology and technique would oust the organic, the human, and it was inherently dictatorial. So he wrote, they were very, very influential. So there has been pockets around. In relation to the awakening, my argument is that they go together, as I've sought to indicate in relation to my life, that the realization that you have to deal with the world and you have to engage with the world is part and parcel of understanding your own spiritual needs. And this is another issue. Are people willing to accept that they're spiritual beings or something else? Because science is trying to dispirit us. They're being very, mm-hmm. very successful. They're trying to take away the idea that you are a spiritual being. For me, my analysis is that, or consistent with the perennial philosophy, that we are consciousness of the highest order, consistent with whatever way you want to conceive divine consciousness, but the greatest awareness that we know of in the universe, we have that in us, and that's where everything comes from ultimately. That's behind everything else. It's behind our persona. It's behind our imagination, and in that, in accessing that, in recognizing us as individuals, we can begin to explore the potential. But unless we accept that, well, then we're willing to be something else. We're willing to be slaves. We're willing to be imprisoned. We're willing to be subjects. We're willing to bow down and grovel to dictators or to
be consumers. That was a big one. We just kind of went into the consumer mode as well. And also a pension, you know, it's like, you know, you have a career and then you have a pension and then you die. You know, it's got to be more than that.
And even the other things, you're a woman and I'm a man. This begins to categorize beyond the humanism of it. So we have to regain the idea that we are humans. And now this sounds strange that we're saying this, but there is the next bit, which is coming on very quick, is the assault on the idea of humanity. It's bad. It's a white male thing. Humanism. They're saying, and I've been reading a lot. I have another book coming out on mm-hmm. transhumanism. But because we're in such a context that there's no time to leave it. But they're saying that humanity is a construction, and the implication of that is they can take it away. You're only a collection of attributes, and it's very, very dangerous, very, very insidious. And this is the next phase, and people will succumb to this gradual fragmentation. There'll be nothing to defend. There'll be no cavalry coming over the hill. There's no one to defend you. The institutions are breaking down because it was meant to break down the institutions. There isn't even any system of law that's going to protect you. I'll say this point before I finish on it. The institutions have failed. They seem to have failed miserably in Ireland. And the legal profession really have manifested extreme cowardice. And I'd say that to a lot of them.
They've apart managed, from Tracy O'Mahony Barrister, we'll give, she's been amazing. From,
I'm in support of people who are taking some.
Yeah, so, she's been amazing. Yeah.
But as a body, they mm-hmm. have ceded. Oh, yeah. They have ceded the people's sovereignty and freedom. And it's been disgusting to hear them talking about how they could circumvent the right to trial by jury. They've been picking the Constitution apart mm-hmm. deliberately, like scavengers. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't. Maybe they think they're doing good, but they don't have enough. No. They don't have enough from their educational background. They don't have any excuse to escape from this. And whatever societal price that we'll pay, they will have spiritual. They will have to face themselves at some stage. We can't mm-hmm. in the near-death experience, as you know, when people have this near-death experience. They're forced to encounter the whole life again and how they have impacted on other people. So that won't be pleasant for a lot of people. You can't get away. If you believe in some sense of a karmic universe, they will pay a big price. So to get to the short point is, it has to be an individual awakening. I don't see a lot. It has to start. But when it starts, that will become very, very powerful, because an individual who is spiritually aware, who begins to explore, who begins to understand, won't tolerate some of the stuff.
It's the most incredible time ever. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. The bell there told us our time is up. We could talk about so many subjects, but it's been wonderful to have you on the show and to get your perspective on things, because, you know, you actually have read the books. We get so many people with their libraries in the background, but we know you've read the books and you've actually retained the information and processed it and come up with your own conclusions. So it's been an absolute pleasure. We wish you the very best luck over in Sweden. And I know now there'll be renewed interest in your paintings and your books and just your individual way of expressing yourself on this earth. So thank you so much, James, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Aisling. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for your good work. And I know you have great things to do in the future, and it's very, very important for people to begin to explore the connections, to learn off each other. You have a lot of experience in the media. You have a lot of experience in how these things work. Thank you for giving me a hearing in this context. And I'm sorry if I rabbited on too long or didn't address your questions or went around.
You're fascinating person. I also want to thank Stephen Kerr, our producer. Thank you so much for putting this all together. We'll be back with a brand new guest next week. Thank you so much for your time. Take care.